Ladies and gentlemen, there is the most amazing launch on the 17th of April at the Hilton Hotel. And this is a book launch, but it's a book launch with a difference. It really is a very, very special function. As you know, we have lots of book launches these days, but when you get somebody quite as classy as this, then it's a different ballgame. So, who am I talking about? Well, he's on the phone right now. Joining me is a man called Alistair Campbell, spin doctor to Tony Blair. He was hailed as a hero for helping get New Labour elected in 1997. The Iraq War was a spin, maybe too far, even for him. But he stuck with Tony Blair and resigned the Labour communications director and strategist in August 2003, just 5 months after the war began. He's got a book out, Winners and How They Succeed. And I've already warmed to this man because I admire and respect people like this, because he's not frightened to get back up into the ring and start all over again. He out-name drops me every time. Nelson Mandela, Alex Ferguson, Richard Branson, David Beckham, and the Queen. Bill Gates. How can you miss Bill Gates? Alistair Campbell, thank you for joining me.
Pleasure.
You have had the most amazing career, haven't you?
It doesn't feel like that, but I guess looking back, I suppose so. I mean, I had a very nice life as a journalist. I enjoyed being a journalist. And then I got into politics, first through journalism, and then when John Smith died, Tony asked me to work for him, and then that was, I guess, the next 10 years of my life taken care of. And then since then, I've done a mix of things. And I mean, it is true that when you go through some of the names, I was very, very lucky about the people that I got to. But you've got to understand, if you get in touch with very famous people and say, I'm writing a book about the greatest winners of all time, it's a lot easier to get them to say yes than if you say you're writing a book about losers. So I think with some of them, it appeals to their sense of vanity.
Alistair, I've got to ask, how important is your good lady and the three children?
Oh, very, very. I mean, it's funny that, because when I first started working for Tony, Fiona didn't want me to and never hid that. And it was very difficult. If you read my previous books, my diaries, then, you know, it's pretty amazing we're still together, to be honest. But no, I think they're fundamental and very.
Before we start talking about the book, looking back, are you pleased with it?
Very, very. I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed doing it, partly because my older son, Rory, he did a lot of the research for me and we did a lot of the interviews together. And in fact, he was one of the people who was pushing me to write the book. I'd been thinking of it for a while. And also, I'll tell you the other thing that I enjoyed was the fact that you just sometimes, I mean, people say you make your own luck, but I did strike very, very lucky. For example, I wanted to interview Anna Wintour, because I thought it was fascinating that she's not just a boss, but she's become almost like a kind of cultural icon within a very important industry, the fashion industry. So I went to New York to interview her. And while I was there, I thought I'll try and get a speaking gig to pay my way. And I ended up speaking at this sports conference on social media. And I just happened in the Q&A, I was asked a question by a woman. And the question sort of troubled me a bit. So I went and talked to her afterwards. And I said, you know, that was a really interesting question, blah, blah, blah. And it turned out she was Floyd Mayweather's PR. So I got in, and I'd been desperate to get, I didn't know how to get hold of Floyd Mayweather, the boxer. I was desperate to interview him because, of course, he's never lost. He's one of the few people who can say, I've never lost. And so that was just lucky. And then, of course, if I do anything, I want to do it well. And if you see the front cover, it's a number one with all the names in the book. So I was desperate for it to get to number one. And I thought, I gave myself a month to do that. And actually, it got to number one in 4 days. So I was very chuffed.
What made you want to write this book? Why Winners?
Partly because I'm interested in the subject and I'm interested in the people. The other thing that made it relatively easy is that I knew a lot of these people already, because I'd met them either through politics or actually I've done a lot of work in sports since I left frontline politics. But I think, to be honest, partly it's because I think as a country, I just have and this is happening around the world, but I just have a fear that we're slightly losing some of our edge in terms of what I call the winning mindset. There's so much grunge and negativity around. So I wanted to write a book about positive people who've done positive things in a great way, but in a way that we can all somehow relate to. I can actually sit down with these people. I mean, like, I've written a chapter about Maradona and visualization. Now, you and I are never going to play football like Maradona. In fact, apart from Ronaldo and Messi, there's nobody on the planet who's ever going to play football like Maradona. But I learned something from Maradona, and I now apply that in my life. I learned things from some of these sports people, some of whom aren't remotely articulate, but there's something about the way they go about what they do. I think all of us, if we look at people who are really excellent in what they do, you can learn something.
I'm talking to Alistair Campbell. The book is called Winners and How They Succeed. You're coming on the 17th of April to the Hilton to a very, very interesting lunch, which is going to be a great day. What's your relationship with Liverpool?
Well, the reason I'm coming on that day is that the next day, my relationship with Liverpool will be the fact that Burnley are going to beat Everton and drag Everton down into the mix at the bottom of the Premier League. I guess, to be absolutely frank, a lot of my relationship with Liverpool is through football. Mm-hmm. I've been, you know, obviously Burnley been up and down through the divisions, but I've been to Anfield and Goodison and indeed Tranmere many times watching Burnley. I guess politically, it is the fact that I've always been a kind of Labour loyalist for whom, at a particular period in our history, Liverpool was, to be absolutely frank, nothing but a problem during the Derek Hatton years and the militant tendency. But I think it's been fascinating to watch Liverpool in recent times. And I do think I get angry at the extent to which I don't think people stand up for the new Labour government nearly enough. But I think actually we did do a lot for places like Liverpool. And most importantly, Liverpool did a lot for itself. And I think that, you know, sometimes these big events that people go for, like London and the Olympics, people think they're kind of overdone and they're overblown. But I think if you look at what Liverpool achieved with the year of culture, European Year of Culture, City of Culture, was a fantastic thing. And I just think Liverpool's one of those cities in the UK. I mean, I've always considered myself British. I've always felt British, but I don't feel English. I feel British and Scottish because of my parents, and I feel northern, not southern, and I think the great northern cities are something that we as a country should be incredibly proud of.
With this lovely book, what comes over loud and clear in the book is that you have respect for age.
For age?
For people who are older. You seem to take from those people and learn from those people.
That's interesting. I heard a radio program the other day, and John Gummer, of all people, was on there. It was Any Questions on the radio. I was driving back from somewhere, and I can't even remember what the question was about, but he said something that I thought was really interesting. He said, "We no longer have role models. We have these wretched celebrities." And I thought that was a very, very good way of putting it. And I think what you define as respecting age, I maybe put as, I think you can always learn from people. And I think you can learn from people both doing things well and doing things badly. And I think, look, I've always tried to have, partly because I get depression, I'd be hard-pressed to say I have a positive outlook on life a lot of the time. But I've always tried to maintain a positive assessment of people, even though I can be very, very critical of people. And I think what this book does, it looks at people that I don't have to like them. I don't like them all, but people that I respect for what they've done and for what they continue to do.
Sorry, I was just going to say, it was interesting you mentioned depression, because I can never get my head around the fact that you have done and gone through so much turmoil, and yet you've come back up again.
Well, I think one of the big chapters in the book and one of the big messages of the book is that resilience is a fantastically important quality. And I think that, look, I mean, I'm talking about Burnley, right? Mm-hmm. It's like I would hate to be a child growing up today supporting Chelsea or Manchester City. Because the reality is, from, you know, the word go, with all the money that's got in, you think you're going to be successful, and it's like you've got a birthright, right? I followed Burnley from the top, they were league champions when I first saw them age 5, to the very, very bottom 25 years later when we had to win the last game of the season to stay in the league. Now, unless you've known, to my mind, unless you've known those bad moments then the good moments don't mean as much. And I think it's the same in life. I look back on my breakdown in the 80s as the best thing that ever happened to me, even though at the time it was the worst thing that ever happened to me.
How did Fiona cope with that?
Well, amazingly well, considering. And again, to be honest, it's pretty extraordinary that she decided to stay with me, because, I mean, I can't... Well, I know I wasn't. I must have been a dreadful person to live with. And... But, you know, I think that is another thing in life, isn't it? I mean, you get lucky sometimes, and I was lucky, I guess, in meeting somebody who did decide to stand by me when many wouldn't.
As a man who's got so much power, and you've been up and down, but it's been amazing if you look at it constantly, are there people that make you prickly? Are there journalists that interview you that you really get under your skin?
Less so now, but there have been, yeah, down the years there have been. In fact, I used to have to brief the press twice a day, 11 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and the morning ones tended to be busier, and then if it was like a European summit or whatever, you're talking about hundreds of people, and there were two or three who could get under my skin. But I didn't want them to know that. And I mentioned Anna Winter. The reason I got the interview with Anna Winter is because I know her brother Patrick very well, who's the political editor of The Guardian. Actually, I like Patrick a lot. And there was one briefing, I can't remember when it was, it was in the early 2000s, and there was a guy from the Daily Mail was really getting under my skin. But I didn't want him to know that it was getting under my skin, so I completely lost it with Patrick over absolutely nothing. And I ended up apologising to him, and I explained to him, I said, look, it was actually somebody else who was getting to me. So, yeah, there's no doubt they can, and I think I'm better at it. And back to the thing about learning from other people, through the work I've done in sport, I've got to know a lot of sports psychologists, and I now use a sports psychologist myself. I mean, partly it's my way of pretending that I'm a proper athlete, and I might one day still get picked for Burnley, because Sean Dyche, we've got a very thin squad. But also it's because, actually... I mean, you talked in your intro about Iraq. I mean, when I went to the Chilcot inquiry, I didn't have any worries about the substance. I didn't have any worries about not being able to deal with any of the questions they put. The worry I had was things like, what do I do if somebody attacks me physically on the way in? What do I do if I have what that Green Party leader had recently, a brain fade? What do I do if I suddenly dry up? Which sometimes happens to people. Now, and I sat down with a guy called Andy McCann, who's in the book, and talked through it. He talked me through it as a sports psychologist, basically on the understanding that this was an event that was going to be live on television, not just in Britain, but in other parts of the world. It was incredibly high profile, very high pressured. And he took me through it in the same way as he'd take a golfer going to the Open or a rugby player in a Grand Slam winning match. Well, and I learned from that.
No. I've got to go back to Fiona. How does she
You're obsessed
cope?
With Fiona.
Yeah, well, I'm a gay man, so I can be, so it's fine. It's fine. How does Fiona enjoy sharing a bed with you and Burnley?
Well, she's not into football.
Okay, well, that's even better, though, isn't
no,
it?
No, she's not into football. In fact, yeah, you know, when I went to the City game at the weekend, and, you know, because it was quite a late kickoff, it meant... whole day gone, didn't get back till late. And the only conversation we had during the day was when I phoned her from Watford saying I was going to be back late for match of the day. Can she record it? But don't worry about just get the Burnley bits. Mm-hmm. And she just doesn't understand that. She doesn't understand that you can go to watch a match and then want to watch it again on television. She doesn't understand it. She tolerates it. She's actually banned from going herself because she did, when we were first going out, she came to a game. Actually, funny enough, she came to a game against Liverpool at Turf Moor where it was a second leg of when the League Cup, whatever it was over two legs. And I think we drew at home, but we'd lost away, so we were out. And she actually said at halftime, before halftime, she said, when's the interval? So you're talking about somebody who doesn't get
my type of lady, my type of lady.
Yeah.
I'm talking to Alistair Campbell. It's a bestseller already, which is fantastic. Alistair Campbell's got a book called Winners and How They Succeed. And he's also coming to a big book launch on the 17th of April at the Hilton in Liverpool. And I say the hottest ticket around. Now, you helped write the script for New Labour's success. Tony Blair was one of the big characters. It's like a soap opera. You normally kill off your best character to get better ratings. Isn't it time to write him out of the Labour Party? Isn't he becoming a national embarrassment?
Oh, that's harsh. I think that's harsh. I'll tell you what I think is the truth, is that... But you've got to remember, 2007, Tony left the House of Commons to a standing ovation from all his peers. Now, what's happened since then is that I think the media... He, in a sense, he stopped being a politician. So for the first 3 years after that, when Gordon was Prime Minister, because he didn't want to be like Thatcher, hanging around like a, you know, a sort of, you know, bad smell over the shoulder of John Major, like Ted Heath had done for her, he vacated the field. He went off and did different things. Since then, he's actually built up an extraordinary organisation. He's employing 250 people, but he's not on public payroll anymore. He has to make the money for that. All the media does is focus on the money that he makes. They never tell you, for example, that a lot of the money he makes, he's pouring it into projects in Africa, in some of the poorest parts of the world, where he's carrying on with some of the work he did as Prime Minister for those countries. So I think it's... And the other thing, I mean, I saw the other day when those candidates said, oh, I'm not taking Tony Blair's money.
Yeah.
Do they want to win or not? The one thing that surely New Labour should have taught the Labour Party is if you don't win, you achieve nothing. So you've got to win.
Now, you've opened the door for the next question, which I've got to ask you because I'm dead curious to see what you say to this. Who and how and what's going to happen with this next general election? Because in all your years, surely this is going to be one of the most open ones for open season.
I think you're right. And it's very, very hard to see how it's going to pan out. I mean, I'll tell you what I hope happens, because I think, like I talked earlier about writing the book, in part as an antidote to all this kind of negativity that there is all the time. And it was great to get out and just talk to really positive people and what have you. But the reality is that there is a negative mood in the country, and a lot of it is about politics. And I just hope that what happens is similar to what happened in Scotland with the referendum campaign, where it went on and on and on for year after year and month after month, and the public were disengaged. And then suddenly it just burst into life. And it was one of the most exciting campaigns I've ever been involved in. It was fantastic. And I hope that happens in the election, because the truth is, people go around the place saying, oh, they're all the same, it doesn't make any difference. They're very, very different. There is so many differences between Tory and Labour, UKIP, Green, SNP. It's a very, very different election to the ones that you and I are used to and the ones that I've been involved in before. And I think it's a fundamentally important election as well, because I honestly do believe, I know I'm biased, I freely admit that, but I do believe if we have five more years of Cameron and Osborne, then you can wave bye-bye to the welfare state as we know it, to the National Health Service as we know it. And I think that people need to face up to the fact that it's not just about the politicians and the media, it's up to the public to engage in these elections. It's too simple for people just to say, oh, they're all the same, oh, I can't be bothered, oh, it makes no difference. I think this is a massively important election, and it's up to people to get engaged.
Stay with Blair for one more moment then. You don't think then they should expel Blair from the Labour Party?
Oh, how can you even suggest that? I mean, the guy is the most successful leader we have ever had. Played three, won three.
You've gone back to football again. It's all about football.
I mean, you know, he's almost as good as Sean Dyche, honestly.
You are outrageous. Tell me, what is this love of football? And then I'm going to leave football completely.
You don't get football, do you?
I used to... Right, do you want the truth? I used to be a Liverpool fan, big Liverpool fan. When Ian St. John played and Alan Ball was at Everton, I was a fan. And then I saw the passion go and it all about money. And it made me very cross and I started changing towards football. That's the truth.
No, I understand that. And you know what? I think football's got to be very, very careful, because when you're... Sometimes, I mean, I love football. I love all sport, actually. I love teams. I love watching teams. I love seeing how they operate. You know, I had a fantastic time, and I've written about it in the book, about when I worked with the British and Irish Lions in New Zealand. And even though we lost, I learned so much just seeing the inside of an elite sports organisation. So I love watching good teams. And that Liverpool team that you were talking about was fantastic. That era for Liverpool was extraordinary. And also, but for me, I've noticed myself, even as a kind of absolutely obsessive football fan, if I'm channel hopping on a weekend when Burnley haven't got a game, and if I see, say, on Spanish League or the Italian League or the Dutch League or the German League, If I see thousands of empty seats, I don't watch. And I think there is a danger with the Premier League that they are so... I mean, it's a fantastic commercial and business success story. It is extraordinary what they've done, right? Mm-hmm. But if the trend just carries on with this idea of players 300,000 a week or an average... I mean, even at Burnley, the top players on 20 grand a week, and that's low. That is low in the Premier League. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a real danger that the connection between community and club and the connection between fans and players just disappears, and it could happen very, very quickly. So I love football because I like the game, I like its simplicity, but I like also the fact that it can be so complicated if you know a bit about it. I love the drama and the passion. I get more, I mean, to be honest, I'd rather watch Burnley reserves against Liverpool reserves than watch Barcelona against Real Madrid, but I will watch Barcelona against Real Madrid because you'll see good football. But I think we've got to be very, very careful. And let's be honest, we still tell ourselves that the top level of English football is the best. I make you a prediction now. I've said this in the book. England will not win a major tournament in our lifetime. And that is because, actually, as a sport, it is not strategic. The Premier League is strategic. That is a big strategic success. But as a sport, as a country, we are not strategic about it in a way that the Germans and the Spaniards have been.
Would you say that you helped to write us into the Iraq War?
No, because that suggests that, as it were, what I did, what my job was as important as the people actually making decisions. What I did was support Tony Blair in the process and also in the communication of what ultimately was the cabinet, his and the cabinet's policy. So that's what I did. That was my job.
If you were in now and Tony Blair was in, how do you think, because you were near to him all the time and you also were, well, you knew what you were doing, how would you write us in or out of the mess with ISIS? Because it is a very scary world.
It is a scary world, and it's not just ISIS. I think I'll tell you a couple of other things that I think really worry people and which are not even on the election agenda for some reason, because David Cameron just seems to have vacated the field on this, is that what's going on in Russia, I think, is really scary. I actually think the debate we're having on Europe is scary. I think the idea of Britain coming out of the European Union is an utter madness. And it's ridiculous that Cameron is allowed to get it as far as it has. I find it scary that he's so cocked up the aftermath of the Scottish referendum that a debate that was won on the vote is now being followed through on the almost on the basis that it was lost, so that Scotland's independence is still on the agenda. And I find all of these things scary. And I think that in relate, but your question specifically about ISIS, and you say, what would Tony say? It's interesting. If you read this book, in the chapter on crisis management, I talk about what happened on 9/11. And I publish a note that I wrote on that very day when we got back from Brighton and Tony was having a load of meetings. And it's a note that I sent round the system of all the things we had to think about based upon conversations that Tony had had on the way back. And one of them was the link between extremist terrorist groups and rogue states with weapons of mass destruction. Now, what I never disrespected, if that word exists, I never disrespected those who disagreed with Tony and the government and what we did. What I can't stand are the people who want to say either that his motives weren't actually as stated, it was nothing to do with a fear about the way that Saddam was developing weapons of mass destruction, which, by the way, every intelligence agency in the world was saying was happening. Nor was it to do with oil or George Bush or anything else. It was him making a decision as British Prime Minister based upon his assessment of our national interests at that time. And the other thing I can't stand are people who say everything that's going on in the Middle East now is as a consequence of Tony Blair and George Bush in relation to Iraq. I think the reason he was so concerned at the time that he was because this debate about and within Islam was happening already. And look, there's no easy option for current prime ministers and current presidents, but I think that one of the problems, people talk about learning the right lessons about Iraq. One of my worries is that people are learning some of the wrong lessons about Iraq. And let me just explain what I mean by that. I think you've got world leaders today who are thinking, oh God, I don't want to be like Bush and Blair and have this thing hanging around me forever. So it's easier not to make a decision. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just as dangerous in its own way as making the difficult decision.
What happens if Labour lose this election?
Well, I hope we don't, but if we do, I think it'll be a disaster for Britain, because I really worry about the direction of travel of the country. I really do. I think that, I mean, George Osborne, people, it's amazing it hasn't had more debate this. His last speech to the last Tory party conference, he basically said that even if they get the deficit sorted, on which they've failed dramatically so far, even if they get it sorted, he would still want to cut spending year on year on year. That's why I say you're talking about the end of the health service and the welfare state as we know it. Now, of course, they both need reform, but I do think this is quite a dangerously ideological right-wing government, the sorts of which make Margaret Thatcher look like a lily-livered liberal.
So the book, Winner or Loser?
For you to decide. For you to decide when you come to the lunch.
And tell me.
The day before Everton are losers against Burnley.
And do you still not do God?
I don't do God, no. I don't do God.
I tell you what...
But I have my moments. I have my moments. Yeah. And I had one at the weekend, fun enough. I had a bit of a moment at the weekend. But no, I don't do God.
I actually don't. I'm having moments as I get older. That's my
problem. Yeah, yeah.
Are you pleased with the book?
I'm very happy with the book. I loved writing it. I really enjoyed writing it. I enjoyed doing it with my son. I enjoyed the fact that we travelled so much together and spoke to so many interesting people. And I'm glad that it's gone to number one. And I've just had a bloke on Twitter, an Australian businessman, who's just bought 500.
Wow.
He's bought 500 for all his staff and all his clients.
Alistair, I want to ask you one more question and I'll let you go. The book is called Winners and How They Succeed. Alistair is going to be with us on the 17th of April at the Hilton. I think he's a fascinating man. I think it's going to be an amazing lunch. It really is going to be an amazing lunch. Last question, really serious question. You mentioned depression, which I'm really glad you mentioned it, because late night phone-ins, as I do, many, many people listen, deal with depression. I have to deal with a little bit of it, but... many people deal with it. How would you advise them to cope?
I think it's very difficult to extrapolate from your own experience to everybody. But just telling you about my own experience, what I've realised over the last few decades is that I probably had a drink problem from my teens. And I think it was probably a form of self-medication, because people didn't know about depression, they didn't talk about depression. And I'm not criticising anybody in my past or my family but the general attitude was to say, look, you know, you've got a great life, pull yourself together. And that is the first thing I'd say is that's the worst thing you can say to anybody who's got depression. You wouldn't say to somebody who's got asthma, you know, for heaven's sake, stop being breathless, pull yourself together. You wouldn't say to somebody who's diabetic, for heaven's sake, you know, stop being diabetic, pull yourself together, or anybody who has cancer. It's an illness. Depression's an illness. Some people get it, some people don't. I have found, but I'm lucky because I don't have to worry about, I don't want a job. I'm never going to apply for another job again, I don't think. I've got fantastic opportunities to have a great life. But I found that openness has helped me. And I've actually found most people understanding and sympathetic, even the media, to be honest. I've had a lot of, you know, CRAP from the media in my time, but on this, they're pretty good. And that, the reality is, we all know people who get depression. We all know people who've got addiction issues. There's nobody in the world who doesn't know somebody. Mm-hmm. And so that openness, I think, is a big step. And then the other thing I'd say is, I think once you've decided to be open, once you feel there are people you can talk to and that they'll listen, and they won't say, pull yourself together. They'll say, okay, well, let's try and talk about this and let's think about it and what can we do? I find, for example, I mean, I've been on medication for the last 16 months. I had a really bad bout of it 16 months ago. And I found a medication, first time ever, that feels like it's working for me. Now, I hate taking medicine, but it's working, so why not? I've found myself, I've got a guy that I see. I don't see him every week, nothing like it. I see him when I feel I need to see him. That works for me. So I think you have to find out what works for you. And then the other thing I found is that you talked about Fiona and the kids. For years and years and years and years, I never mentioned it. And I used to, sometimes I'd disappear. If it was really bad, I'd just say, I've got to go away for a couple of days. And I'd, you know, make up an excuse or whatever. But actually now, I'm completely open. And my daughter in particular, she always says, what can we do? And I always say, look, just understand, first thing is, from your perspective, this is not your fault, and never ever blame yourself for it. But the second thing is, the only thing you can do is be there at the start and be there at the end and understand I'm exactly the same person, just that I've gone through a bad phase. And I just think that's the, if we could all approach it with that level of openness like we do with physical illness, I just think we'd all be better off.
Alistair Campbell, the book is called Winners and How They Succeed. I was nervous to interview you, and I've been doing it for 100 years, but I actually think you're a nice guy. And I look forward to meeting you on the 17th of April at the Hilton for the lunch and get my book signed.
See you there.